The searchers unearthed two buried vaults full of quicklime and human remains. They theorized the remains might be the last traces of two Texas women, Minnie and Anna Williams, whom Chicago police only recently learned were missing. In the ash of a large stove, they found a length of chain which the jeweler in Holmes's pharmacy recognized as part of a watch chain that Holmes had given Minnie Williams as a gift. They also found a letter Holmes had written to the pharmacist in his drugstore. "Do you ever see anything of the ghost of the Williams sisters?" Holmes wrote. "And do they trouble you much now?" The next day, the police discovered another hidden chamber, this one at the cellar's southwest corner. They were led to it by a man named Charles Chappell, alleged to have helped Holmes reduce corpses to bone. He was very cooperative, and soon the police recovered three fully articulated skeletons from their owners. A fourth was expected from Chicago's Hahnemann Medical College. One of the most striking discoveries came on the second floor in the walk-in vault. The inside of the door showed the unmistakable imprint of a woman's bare foot. Police theorized the print had been made by a woman suffocating within. Her name, they believed, was Emmeline Sigrund. Chicago police telegraphed District Attorney Graham that their search of the Holmes building had uncovered the skeleton of a child. Graham ordered Geyer to Chicago to see if the remains might be those of Howard Pitetzel. Geyer found the city transfixed by the revelations emerging from the castle. Press coverage had been exhaustive, taking up most of the front page of the daily newspapers. One Tribune headline had cried, "Victims of a Fiend," and reported erroneously that the remains of Howard Pitetzel had been found in the building. The story took up six of the seven columns of the front page. Geyer met with the lead police inspector and learned that a physician who had examined the child's skeleton had ruled it to be that of a little girl. The inspector thought he knew the girl's identity and mentioned a name, Pearl Connor. The name meant nothing to Geyer. Geyer telegraphed his disappointment to Graham, who ordered him back to Philadelphia for consultation and rest. On Wednesday evening, August 7th, with temperatures in the 90s and train cars like ovens, Geyer set out again, this time accompanied by Fidelity Mutual's top insurance investigator, Inspector W.E. Gary. Geyer was glad for the company. They went to Chicago, then to Indiana, where they stopped in Logansport and Peru, then to Montpelier Junction, Ohio, and Adrian, Michigan. They spent days searching the records of every hotel, boarding house, and real estate office they could find. All, Geyer said, to no purpose. Although Geyer's brief rest in Philadelphia had recharged his hopes, now he found them fast dwindling away. He still believed his original instinct was correct, that Howard was in Indianapolis or somewhere nearby. He went there next, his third visit of the summer. "I must confess I returned to Indianapolis in no cheerful frame of mind," Geyer wrote. He and Inspector Gary checked into Geyer's old hotel, the Spencer House. The failure to find Howard after so much effort was frustrating and puzzling. The mystery, Geyer wrote, seemed to be impenetrable. On Thursday, August 19th, Geyer learned that during the preceding night, Holmes's castle in Englewood, his own dark dreamland, had burned to the ground. Front page headlines in the Chicago Tribune shouted, "Holmes's den burned. Fire demolishes the place of murder and mystery." The fire department suspected arson. Police theorized that whoever set the fire had wanted to destroy the secrets still embedded within. They arrested no one. Together, Detective Geyer and Inspector Gary investigated 900 leads. They expanded their search to include small towns outside the city. "By Monday," Geyer wrote in a report to Superintendent Linden in Philadelphia, We will have searched every outlying town except Irvington, and another day we'll conclude that. After Irvington, I scarcely know where we shall go. They went to Irvington on Tuesday morning, August 27, 1895, aboard an electric trolley, a new kind of streetcar that drew its power through a wheeled conducting apparatus on the roof called a troller. Just before the trolley reached its final stop, Geyer spotted a sign for a real estate office. He and Gary resolved to begin their search there. The proprietor was a Mr. Brown. He offered the detectives each a chair, but they remained standing. They did not think the visit would last long, and there were many other offices to touch before nightfall. Geyer opened his now soiled parcel of photographs. Brown adjusted his glasses and examined the picture of Holmes. After a long pause, he said, "I did not have the renting of the house, but I had the keys, and one day last fall this man came into my office and in a very abrupt way said, 'I want the keys for that house.'" Geyer and Gary stood very still. Brown continued, "I remember the man very well because I did not like his manner, and I felt that he should have had more respect for my gray hairs." The detectives looked at one another. Both sat down at the same time. "All the toil," Geyer said, "all the weary days and weeks of travel. Toil and travel in the hottest months of the year, alternating between faith and hope and discouragement and despair. All were recompensed in that one moment when I saw the veil about to lift." At the inquest that followed, a young man named Elvet Moorman testified he had helped Holmes set up a large wood stove in the house. He recalled asking Holmes why he didn't install a gas stove instead. Holmes answered that he did not think gas was healthy for children. The owner of an Indianapolis repair shop testified that Holmes had come into his shop on October 3, 1894, with two cases of surgical instruments, and asked to have them sharpened. Holmes picked them up 3 days later. Detective Geyer testified as to how, during his search of the house, he opened the base of a chimney flue that extended from roof to cellar. While sifting the accumulated ash through a fly screen, he found human teeth and a fragment of jaw. He also retrieved a large, charred mass, which upon being cut disclosed a portion of the stomach, liver, and spleen, baked quite hard. The organs had been packed too tightly into the chimney, and thus never had burned. And, of course, Mrs. Pititzel was summoned. She identified Howard's overcoat and his scarf pin, and a crochet needle that belonged to Alice. Finally, the coroner showed her a toy that Geyer himself had found in the house. It consisted of a tin man mounted on a spinning top. She recognized it. How could she not? It was Howard's most important possession. Mrs. Pititzel herself had put it in the children's trunk just before she sent them off with Holmes. His father had bought it for him at the Chicago World's Fair. Malice aforethought. On September 12, 1895, a Philadelphia grand jury voted to indict Holmes for the murder of Benjamin Pititzel. Only two witnesses presented evidence: L.G. Faust, president of Fidelity Mutual Life, and Detective Frank Geyer. Holmes stuck to his claim that Minnie Williams and the mysterious Hatch had killed the children. Grand juries in Indianapolis and Toronto found this unconvincing. Indianapolis indicted Holmes for the murder of Howard Pititzel, Toronto for the murders of Alice and Nellie. If Philadelphia failed to convict him, there would be two more chances. If the city succeeded, the other indictments would be moot, for given the nature of the Pititzel murder, a conviction in Philadelphia would bring a death sentence. Holmes's memoir reached newsstands. In its final pages, he stated, In conclusion, I wish to say that I am but a very ordinary man, even below average in physical strength and mental ability, and to have planned and executed the stupendous amount of wrongdoing that has been attributed to me would have been wholly beyond my power. He asked the public to suspend judgment while he worked to disprove the charges against him, a task which I feel able to satisfactorily and expeditiously accomplish. And here, I cannot say, Finis, it is not the end. For besides doing this, there is also the work of bringing to justice those for whose wrongdoings I am today suffering, and this not to prolong or save my own life, for since the day I heard of the Toronto horror I have not cared to live, but that to those who have looked up to and honored me in the past, it shall not in the future be said that I suffered the ignominious death of a murderer. The thing editors could not understand was how Holmes had been able to escape serious investigation by the Chicago police. The Chicago Inter-Ocean said, "It is humiliating to think that had it not been for the exertions of the insurance companies which Holmes swindled, or attempted to swindle, he might yet be at large, preying upon society, so well did he cover up the traces of his crime." Chicago's feeling of humiliation was not surprising, the New York Times said. Anyone familiar with the saga must be amazed at the failure of the municipal police department and the local prosecuting officers not only to prevent those awful crimes, but even to procure any knowledge of them. One of the most surprising and perhaps dismaying revelations was that Chicago's chief of police, in his prior legal career, had represented Holmes in a dozen routine commercial lawsuits. The Chicago Times-Herald took the broad view and said of Holmes, "He is a prodigy of wickedness, a human demon, a being so unthinkable that no novelist would dare to invent such a character." The story, too, tends to illustrate the end of the century. Epilogue. The Last Crossing. The Fair. The fair had a powerful and lasting impact on the nation's psyche, in ways both large and small. Walt Disney's father Elias helped build the White City. Walt's Magic Kingdom may well be a descendant. Certainly the fair made a powerful impression on the Disney family. It proved such a financial boon that when the family's third son was born that year, Elias, in gratitude, wanted to name him Columbus. His wife Flora intervened. The baby became Roy. Walt came next on December 5th, 1901. The writer L. Frank Baum and his artist partner William Wallace Denslow visited the fair. Its grandeur informed their creation of Oz. The Japanese temple on the wooded island charmed Frank Lloyd Wright and influenced the evolution of his prairie residential designs. The fair prompted President Harrison to designate October 12th a national holiday, Columbus Day, which today serves to anchor a few thousand parades and a three-day weekend. Every carnival since 1893 has included a midway and a Ferris wheel, and every grocery store contains products born at the exposition. Shredded wheat did survive. Every house has scores of incandescent bulbs powered by alternating current, both of which first proved themselves worthy of large-scale use at the fair. And nearly every town of any size has its little bit of ancient Rome, some beloved and becolumned bank, library, or post office. Covered with graffiti, perhaps, or even an ill-conceived coat of paint, but underneath it all, the glow of the White City persists. Even the Lincoln Monument in Washington can trace its heritage to the fair. The fair's greatest impact lay in how it changed the way Americans perceived their cities and their architects. It primed the whole of America, not just a few rich architectural patrons, to think of cities in a way they never had before. Elihu Root said the fair led our people out of the wilderness of the commonplace to new ideas of architectural beauty and nobility. Henry Demarest Lloyd saw it as revealing to the great mass of Americans possibilities of social beauty, utility, and harmony of which they had not been able even to dream. No such vision could otherwise have entered into the prosaic drudgery of their lives, and it will be felt in their development into the third and fourth generation. The fair taught men and women steeped only in the necessary to see that cities did not have to be dark, soiled, and unsafe bastions of the strictly pragmatic. They could also be beautiful. William Stead recognized the power of the fair immediately. The vision of the white city and its profound contrast to the black city drove him to write If Christ Came to Chicago, a book often credited with launching the City Beautiful movement, which sought to elevate American cities to the level of the great cities of Europe. Like Stead, civic authorities throughout the world saw the fair as a model of what to strive for. They asked Burnham to apply the same citywide thinking that had gone into the white city to their own cities. He became a pioneer in modern urban planning. He created citywide plans for Cleveland, San Francisco, and Manila, and led the turn-of-the-century effort to resuscitate and expand L'Enfant's vision of Washington, D.C. In each case, he worked without a fee. While helping design the new Washington plan, Burnham persuaded the head of the Pennsylvania Railroad, Alexander Cassatt, to remove his freight tracks and depot from the center of the Federal Mall, thus creating the unobstructed green that extends today from the Capitol to the Lincoln Memorial. Other cities came to Daniel Burnham for citywide plans, among them Fort Worth, Atlantic City, and St. Louis. But he turned them down to concentrate on his last plan, for the city of Chicago. Over the years, many aspects of his Chicago plan were adopted, among them the creation of the city's lovely ribbon of lakefront parks and Michigan Avenue's Miracle Mile. One portion of the lakefront, named Burnham Park in his honor, contains Soldier Field and the Field Museum, which he designed. The park runs south in a narrow green border along the lakeshore all the way to Jackson Park, where the fair's Palace of Fine Arts, transformed into a permanent structure, now houses the Museum of Science and Industry. It looks out over the lagoons and the wooded island, now a wild and tangled place that perhaps would make Olmsted smile, though no doubt he would find features to criticize. Early in the 20th century, the fair became a source of heated debate among architects. Critics claimed the fair extinguished the Chicago School of Architecture, an indigenous vernacular, and replaced it with a renewed devotion to obsolete classical styles. Parroted from thesis to thesis, this view first gained prominence through a curiously personal dynamic that made it difficult and, as is often the case in the cramped and stuffy rooms of academic debate, even dangerous to resist. It was Lewis Sullivan who first and most loudly condemned the fair's influence on architecture, but only late in his life and long after Burnham's death. Things had not gone well for Sullivan after the fair. During the first year of the post-fair depression, the firm of Adler and Sullivan received only two commissions. In 1895, none. In July 1895, Adler quit the firm. Sullivan was 38 and incapable of cultivating the relationships that might have generated enough new commissions to keep him solvent. He was a loner and intellectually intolerant. When a fellow architect asked Sullivan for suggestions on how to improve one of his designs, Sullivan replied, "If I told you, you wouldn't know what I was talking about." As his practice faltered, Sullivan found himself forced to leave his office in the auditorium and to sell his personal belongings. He drank heavily and took mood-altering drugs called bromides. Between 1895 and 1922, Sullivan built only 25 new structures, roughly one a year. From time to time he came to Burnham for money, although whether he sought outright loans or sold Burnham artwork from his personal collection is unclear. An entry in Burnham's diary for 1911 states, "Lewis Sullivan called to get more money of D.H.B." That same year, Sullivan inscribed a set of drawings to Daniel H. Burnham, with the best wishes of his friend, Louis H. Sullivan. But Sullivan laced his 1924 autobiography with hyperbolic attacks on Burnham and the fair's impact on the masses who came through its gates. The classical architecture of the White City made such a profound impression, Sullivan claimed, that it doomed America to another half-century of imitation. The fair was a contagion, a virus, a form of progressive cerebral meningitis. In his view, it had fatal consequences. Thus, architecture died in the land of the free and the home of the brave, in a land declaring its fervid democracy, its inventiveness, its resourcefulness, its unique daring, enterprise, and progress. Sullivan's low opinion of Burnham and the fair was counterbalanced only by his own exalted view of himself, and what he saw as his role in attempting to bring to architecture something fresh and distinctly American. Frank Lloyd Wright took up Sullivan's banner. Sullivan had fired him in 1893, but later Wright and Sullivan became friends. As Wright's academic star rose, so too did Sullivan's. Burnham's fell from the sky. It became de rigueur among architectural critics and historians to argue that Burnham, in his insecurity and slavish devotion to the classical yearnings of the Eastern architects, had indeed killed American architecture. But that view was too simplistic, as architectural historians and critics have more recently acknowledged. The fair awakened America to beauty, and as such was a necessary passage that laid the foundation for men like Frank Lloyd Wright and Mies van der Rohe. For Burnham personally, the fair had been an unqualified triumph. It allowed him to fulfill his pledge to his parents to become the greatest architect in America, for certainly in his day he had become so. During the fair, an event occurred whose significance to Burnham was missed by all but his closest friends. Both Harvard and Yale granted him honorary master's degrees in recognition of his achievement in building the fair. The ceremonies occurred on the same day. He attended Harvard's. For him, the awards were a form of redemption. His past failure to gain admission to both universities, the denial of his right beginning, had haunted him throughout his life. Even years after the awards, as he lobbied Harvard to grant provisional admission to his son Daniel, whose own performance on the entry exams was far from stellar, Burnham wrote, "He needs to know that he is a winner, and, as soon as he does, he will show his real quality, as I have been able to do. It is the keenest regret of my life that someone did not follow me up at Cambridge and let the authorities know what I could do." Burnham had shown them himself in Chicago through the hardest sort of work. He bristled at the persistent belief that John Root deserved most of the credit for the beauty of the fair. "What was done up to the time of his death was the faintest suggestion of a plan," he said. "The impression concerning his part has been gradually built up by a few people, close friends of his, and mostly women, who naturally, after the fair proved beautiful, desired to more broadly identify his memory with it." Root's death had crushed Burnham, but it also freed him to become a broader, better architect. "It was questioned by many if the loss of Mr. Root was not irreparable," wrote James Ellsworth in a letter to Burnham's biographer Charles Moore. Ellsworth concluded that Root's death brought out qualities in Mr. Burnham which might not have developed, as early anyway, had Mr. Root lived. The common perception had always been that Burnham managed the business side of the firm, while Root did all the designs. Burnham did seem to lean more or less on Root's artistic abilities, Ellsworth said, but added that after Root's death, "one would never realize anything of this kind, or ever know from his actions that he ever possessed a partner or did not always command in both directions." In 1901, Burnham built the Fuller Building at the triangular intersection of 23rd and Broadway in New York, but neighborhood residents found an uncanny resemblance to a common domestic tool and called it the Flatiron Building. Burnham and his firm went on to build scores of other structures, among them the Gimbel's Department Store in New York, Philene in Boston, and the Mount Wilson Observatory in Pasadena, California. Of the 27 buildings he and John Root built in Chicago's Loop, only three remain today, among them the Rookery, its top-floor library much as it was during that magical meeting in February 1891, and the Reliance Building, beautifully transformed into the Hotel Burnham. Its restaurant is called the Atwood, after Charles Atwood, who replaced Root as Burnham's chief designer. Burnham became an early environmentalist. "Up to our time," he said, "strict economy in the use of natural resources has not been practiced. But it must be, henceforth, unless we are immoral enough to impair conditions in which our children are to live." He had great, if misplaced, faith in the automobile. "The passing of the horse would end a plague of barbarism," he said. "When this change comes, a real step in civilization will have been taken. With no smoke, no gases, no litter of horses, your air and streets will be clean and pure. This means, does it not, that the health and spirits of men will be better?" On winter nights in Evanston, he and his wife went sleigh riding with Mr. and Mrs. Frank Lloyd Wright. Burnham became an avid player of bridge, though he was known widely for being utterly inept at the game. It is possible he had a lover. One letter from an address on Pine Street in San Francisco: "I pen this to tell you that I think of you with real love, lots of times in the daytime, and when I lie awake at night." He had promised his wife that after the exposition, the pace of his work would ease. But this did not happen. He told Margaret, "I thought the fair was an intense life, but I find the pressing forward of all these important interests gives me quite as full a day, week, or year." Burnham's health began to decline early in the 20th century, when he was in his 50s. He developed colitis and in 1909 learned he had diabetes. Both conditions forced him to adopt a more healthful diet. His diabetes damaged his circulatory system and caused a foot infection that bedeviled him for the rest of his life. As the years passed, he revealed an interest in the supernatural. One night in San Francisco, in a bungalow he had built at the fog-licked summit of Twin Peaks, his planning shanty, he told a friend, "If I were able to take the time, I believe that I could prove the continuation of life beyond the grave, reasoning from the necessity, philosophically speaking, of a belief in an absolute and universal power." He knew that his day was coming to an end. On July 4th, 1909, as he stood with friends on the roof of the Reliance Building, looking out over the city he adored, he said, "You'll see it lovely." "I never will, but it will be lovely." Recessional. The roaring in Olmsted's ears, the pain in his mouth, and the sleeplessness never eased, and soon an emptiness began to appear in his gaze. He became forgetful. On May 10, 1895, 2 weeks after his 73rd birthday, he wrote to his son John, "It has today for the first time become evident to me that my memory for recent occurrences is no longer to be trusted." He was 73 years old. That summer, on his last day in the Brookline office, he wrote three letters to George Vanderbilt, each saying pretty much the same thing. "During a period in September 1895 that he described as the bitterest week of my life, he confessed to his friend Charles Eliot his terror that his condition soon would require that he be placed in an asylum. You cannot think how I have been dreading that it would be thought expedient that I should be sent to an institution," he wrote on September 26th. "Anything but that. My father was a director of an insane retreat, and first and last, having been professionally employed and behind the scenes in several, my dread of such places is intense." His loss of memory accelerated. He became depressed and paranoid and accused son John of orchestrating a coup to remove him from the firm. Olmsted's wife Mary took Olmsted to the family's island home in Maine, where his depression deepened and he at times became violent. He beat the family horse. Mary and her sons realized there was little they could do for Olmsted. He had become unmanageable, his dementia profound. With deep sorrow and perhaps a good deal of relief, Rick lodged his father in the McLean Asylum in Waverly, Massachusetts. Olmsted's memory was not so destroyed that he did not realize he himself had designed McLean's grounds. This gave him no solace, for he saw immediately that the same phenomenon that had diminished nearly every one of his works, Central Park, Biltmore, the World's Fair, and so many others, had occurred yet again. "They didn't carry out my plan," he wrote. "Confound them!" Olmsted died at 2 a.m. on August 28, 1903. His funeral was spare, family only. His wife, who had seen this great man disappear before her eyes, did not attend. The Ferris wheel cleared $200,000 at the fair and remained in place until the spring of 1894, when George Ferris dismantled it and reassembled it on Chicago's north side. By then, however, it had lost both its novelty and the volume of ridership that the Midway had guaranteed. The wheel began losing money. These losses, added to the $150,000 cost of moving it and the financial damage done to Ferris's steel inspection company by the continuing depression, caused Ferris to sell most of his ownership of the wheel. In the autumn of 1896, Ferris and his wife separated. She went home to her parents. He moved into the Duquesne Hotel in downtown Pittsburgh. On November 17, 1896, he was taken to Mercy Hospital, where he died 5 days later, apparently of typhoid fever. He was 37 years old. 1 year later, his ashes were still in the possession of the undertaker who had received his body. The request of Mrs. Ferris for the ashes was refused, the undertaker said, because the dead man left closer relatives. In a eulogy, two friends said Ferris had miscalculated his powers of endurance, and he died a martyr to his ambition for fame and prominence. In 1903, the Chicago House Wrecking Company bought the wheel at auction for $8,150, then reassembled it at the Louisiana Purchase Exposition of 1904. There, the wheel again became profitable and earned its new owners $215,000. On May 11, 1906, the wrecking company dynamited the wheel for scrap. The first 100-pound charge was supposed to cut the wheel loose from its supports and topple it onto its side. Instead, the wheel began a slow turn, as if seeking one last roll through the sky. It crumpled under its own weight into a mountain of bent steel. Saul Bloom, chief of the Midway, emerged from the fair a rich young man. He invested heavily in a company that bought perishable foods and shipped them in the latest refrigerated cars to far-off cities. It was a fine, forward-looking business. But the Pullman strike halted all train traffic through Chicago, and the perishable foods rotted in their train cars. He was ruined. He was still young, however, and still Bloom. He used his remaining funds to buy two expensive suits, on the theory that whatever he did next, he had to look convincing. "But one thing was quite clear," he wrote. "Being broke didn't disturb me in the least. I had started with nothing, and if I now found myself with nothing, I was at least even. Actually, I was much better than even. I had had a wonderful time." Bloom went on to become a congressman and one of the crafters of the charter that founded the United Nations. The fair made Buffalo Bill $1 million, about $30 million today, which he used to found the town of Cody, Wyoming, build a cemetery and fairground for North Platte, Nebraska, pay the debts of 5 North Platte churches, acquire a Wisconsin newspaper, and further the theatrical fortunes of a lovely young actress named Catherine Clemens, thereby deepening the already pronounced alienation of his wife. At one point, he accused his wife of trying to poison him. The panic of 1907 destroyed his Wild West and forced him to hire himself out to circuses. He was over 70 years old, but still rode the ring under his big white hat trimmed in silver. He died in Denver at his sister's house on January 10, 1917, without even the money to pay for his burial. Theodore Dreiser married Sarah Osborne White. In 1898, 2 years before publishing Sister Carrie, he wrote to Sarah, "I went to Jackson Park and saw what is left of the dear old World's Fair where I learned to love you." He cheated on her repeatedly. For Dora Root, life with John had been like living upon a comet. Their marriage had brought her into a world of art and money where everything seemed energized and alive. Her husband's wit, his musical talent, those exquisite long fingers so evident in any photograph, imparted a gleam to her days that she was never able to recapture after his death. Toward the end of the first decade of the 20th century, she wrote a long letter to Burnham. "It means so much to me that you think I have done well all these years," she wrote. "I have such grave doubts about myself whenever I stop to think about the subject, that a word of encouragement from one who has so wonderfully sounded out his life gives me a new impetus. If absorbing myself before the coming generation and humbly passing on the torch is the whole duty of women, I believe I have earned a word of praise." But she knew that with John's death, the doors to a brighter kingdom had softly but firmly closed. "If John had lived," she told Burnham, "all would have been different. Under the stimulus of his exhilarating life, I would have been his wife as well as the mother of his children. And it would have been interesting." Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast stood trial in December 1893. The prosecutor was a criminal attorney hired by the state just for this case. His name was Alfred S. Trude. Prendergast's lawyers tried to prove Prendergast was insane, but a jury of angry, grieving Chicagoans believed otherwise. One important piece of evidence tending to support the prosecution's case for sanity was the care Prendergast had taken to keep an empty chamber under the hammer of his revolver as he carried it in his pocket. At 2:28 p.m. on December 29th, after conferring for an hour and 3 minutes, the jury found him guilty. The judge sentenced him to death. Throughout his trial and subsequent appeal, he continued to send Trude postcards. He wrote on February 21st, 1894, "No one should be put to death, no matter who it is, if it can be avoided. It is demoralizing to society to be barbarous." Clarence Darrow entered the case and, in a novel maneuver, won for Prendergast a sanity inquest. This too failed, however, and Prendergast was executed. Darrow called him a poor, demented imbecile. The execution intensified Darrow's already deep hatred of the death penalty. "I am sorry for all fathers and all mothers," he said years later, during his defense of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, accused of killing a Chicago boy for the thrill of it. "The mother who looks into the blue eyes of her little babe cannot help musing over the end of the child, whether it will be crowned with the greatest promises which her mind can image, or whether he may meet death upon the scaffold." Leopold and Loeb, as they became known worldwide, had stripped their victim to mask his identity. They dumped some of his clothes in Olmsted's lagoons at Jackson Park. In New York, at the Waldorf Astoria, a few years into the new century, several dozen young men in evening clothes gathered around a gigantic pie. The whipped cream topping began to move. A woman emerged. She was stunning, with olive skin and long black hair. Her name was Ferida Majar. The men were too young to remember, but once, a long while before, she had done the Danse du Ventre at the greatest fair in history. What the men noticed now was that she wore nothing at all. Holmes. In the fall of 1895, Holmes stood trial in Philadelphia for the murder of Benjamin F. Pititzel. District Attorney George Graham brought 35 witnesses to Philadelphia from Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Irvington, Detroit, Toronto, Boston, Burlington, and Fort Worth, but they never were called. The judge ruled Graham could present only evidence tied directly to the Pititzel murder, and thus eliminated from the historical record a rich seam of detail on the murders of Dr. Herman W. Mudgett, alias Holmes. Graham also brought to the courtroom the wart Holmes had removed from Benjamin Pititzel's corpse, and a wooden box containing Pititzel's skull. There was a good deal of macabre testimony about decomposition and body fluids and the effects of chloroform. "There was a red fluid issuing from his mouth," testified Dr. William Scott, a pharmacist who had accompanied police to the house where Pititzel's body had been discovered. "And any little pressure on the stomach or over the chest here would cause this fluid to flow more rapidly." After one particularly grisly stretch of Dr. Scott's testimony, Holmes stood and said, "I would ask that the court be adjourned for sufficient time for lunch." There were sorrowful moments, especially when Mrs. Pititzel took the stand. She wore a black dress, black hat, and black cape, and looked pale and sad. Often she paused in mid-sentence and rested her head on her hands. Graham showed her the letters from Alice and Nellie and asked her to identify the handwriting. These were a surprise to her. She broke down. Holmes showed no emotion. "It was an expression of utmost indifference," a reporter for the Philadelphia Public Ledger said. "He made his notes with a manner as unconcerned as if he were sitting in his own office writing a business letter." Graham asked Mrs. Pititzel whether she had seen the children since the time in 1894 when Holmes took them away. She answered in a voice almost too soft to hear, "I saw them at Toronto in the morgue, side by side." So many handkerchiefs appeared among the men and women in the gallery that the courtroom looked as if it had just experienced a sudden snowfall. Graham called Holmes the most dangerous man in the world. The jury found him guilty. The judge sentenced him to death by hanging. Holmes's attorneys appealed the conviction and lost. As Holmes awaited execution, he prepared a long confession, his third, in which he admitted killing 27 people. As with two previous confessions, this one was a mixture of truth and falsehood. A few of the people he claimed to have murdered turned out to be alive. Exactly how many people he killed won't ever be known. At the very least, he killed 9. Julia and Pearl Connor, Emmeline Sigrund, the Williams sisters, and Pititzel and his children. No one doubted that he had killed many others. Estimates ranged as high as 200, though such extravagance seems implausible, even for a man of his appetite. Detective Geyer believed that if the Pinkertons had not caught up with Holmes and arranged his arrest in Boston, he would have killed the rest of the Pititzel family. That he fully intended to murder Mrs. Pititzel and Desi and the baby Wharton is too evident for contradiction. Holmes, in his confession, also clearly lied, or at least was deeply deluded, when he wrote, "I am convinced that since my imprisonment, I have changed woefully and gruesomely from what I was formerly in feature and figure. My head and face are gradually assuming an elongated shape. I believe fully that I am growing to resemble the devil, that the similitude is almost completed." His description of killing Alice and Nellie rang true, however. He said he placed the girls in a large trunk and made an opening in its top. "Here I left them until I could return and, at my leisure, kill them. At 5 p.m. I borrowed a spade of a neighbor and at the same time called on Mrs. Pititzel at her hotel. I then returned to my hotel and ate my dinner, and at 7 o'clock p.m. I again returned to the house where the children were imprisoned and ended their lives by connecting the gas with the trunk. Then came the opening of the trunk and the viewing of their little blackened and distorted faces, then the digging of their shallow graves in the basement of the house. He said of Pitatzel, "It will be understood that from the first hour of our acquaintance, even before I knew he had a family who would later afford me additional victims for the gratification of my bloodthirstiness, I intended to kill him. Afraid that someone would steal his own body after his execution, Holmes left instructions with his lawyers for how he was to be buried. He refused to allow an autopsy. His lawyers turned down an offer of $5,000 for his body. The Wistar Institute in Philadelphia wanted his brain. This request, too, the lawyers refused, much to the regret of Milton Greeman, curator of Wistar's renowned collection of medical anomalies. The man was something more than a mere criminal who acted on impulse, Greeman said. He was a man who studied crime and planned his career. His brain might have given science valuable aid." Shortly before 10 a.m. on May 7, 1896, after a breakfast of boiled eggs, dry toast, and coffee, Holmes was escorted to the gallows at Moyamensing Prison. This was a difficult moment for his guards. They liked Holmes. They knew he was a killer, but he was a charming killer. The assistant superintendent, a man named Richardson, seemed nervous as he readied the noose. Holmes turned to him and smiled and said, "Take your time, old man." At 10:13, Richardson released the trap and hanged him. Using Holmes's instructions, workmen in the employ of undertaker John J. O'Rourke filled a coffin with cement, then placed Holmes's body inside and covered it with more cement. They hauled him south through the countryside to Holy Cross Cemetery, a Catholic burial ground in Delaware County, just south of Philadelphia. With great effort, they transferred the heavy coffin to the cemetery's central vault, where two Pinkerton detectives guarded the body overnight. They took turns sleeping in a white pine coffin. The next day, workers opened a double grave and filled this, too, with cement, then inserted the coffin. They placed more cement on top and closed the grave. Holmes's idea was evidently to guard his remains in every way from scientific enterprise, from the pickling vat and the knife, the Public Ledger reported. Strange things began to happen that made Holmes's claims about being the devil seem almost plausible. Detective Geyer became seriously ill. The warden of Moyamensing Prison committed suicide. The jury foreman was electrocuted in a freak accident. The priest who delivered Holmes's last rites was found dead on the grounds of his church of mysterious causes. The father of Emmeline Sigrund was grotesquely burned in a boiler explosion. And a fire destroyed the office of District Attorney George Graham, leaving only a photograph of Holmes unscathed. No stone or tomb marks the grave of Herman Webster Mudgett, alias H.H. Holmes. His presence in Holy Cross Cemetery is something of a secret, recorded only in an ancient registry volume that lists his location as Section 15, Range 10, Lot 41, at the center of graves 3 and 4, just off a lane that the cemetery calls Lazarus Avenue, after the biblical character who died and was restored to life. The entry also notes 10 feet of cement. At the gravesite, there is only an open lawn in the midst of other old graves. There are children and a World War I pilot. No one ever left flowers here for Holmes, but as it happens, he was not entirely forgotten. In 1997, police in Chicago arrested a physician named Michael Swango at O'Hare Airport. The initial charge was fraud, but Swango was suspected of being a serial killer who murdered hospital patients through the administration of lethal doses of drugs. Eventually, Dr. Swango pled guilty to 4 murders, but investigators believed he committed many more. During the airport arrest, police found in Swango's possession a notebook in which he had copied passages from certain books, either for the inspiration they provided or because of some affirming resonance. One passage was from a book about H.H. Holmes called The Torture Doctor by David Frank. The copied passage sought to put the reader into Holmes's mind. He could look at himself in a mirror and tell himself that he was one of the most powerful and dangerous men in the world, Swango's notebook read. He could feel that he was a god in disguise. Aboard the Olympic. Aboard the Olympic, Burnham waited for more news of Frank Millet and his ship. Just before sailing, he had written in longhand a 19-page letter to Millet, urging him to attend the next meeting of the Lincoln Commission, which was then on the verge of deciding who would be awarded the commission to design the Lincoln Memorial. Burnham and Millet had lobbied strongly for Henry Bacon of New York, and Burnham believed that his earlier talk to the Lincoln Commission had been persuasive. But I know, and you know, dear Frank, that the rats swarm back and begin to gnaw at the same old spot the moment the dog's back is turned. He stressed how important it was for Millet to attend. Be there and reiterate the real argument, which is that they should select a man in whom we have confidence. I leave this thing confidently in your hands. He addressed the envelope himself, certain that the United States Post Office would know exactly what to do. Honorable F. D. Millet, to arrive on steamship Titanic, New York. Burnham hoped that once the Olympic reached the side of Titanic's sinking, he would find Millet alive and hear him tell some outrageous story about the voyage. But during the night, the Olympic returned to its original course for England. Another vessel already had reached Titanic. But there was a second reason for the Olympic's return to course. The builder of both ships, J. Bruce Ismay, himself a Titanic passenger but one of the few male passengers to survive, was adamant that none of the other survivors see this duplicate of their own lost liner coming to their aid. The shock, he feared, would be too great and too humiliating to the White Star Line. The magnitude of the Titanic disaster quickly became apparent. Burnham lost his friend. The steward lost his son. William Stead also had been aboard and was drowned. In 1886, in the Pall Mall Gazette, Stead had warned of the disasters likely to occur if shipping companies continued operating liners with too few lifeboats. A Titanic survivor reported hearing him say, "I think it is nothing serious, so I shall turn in again." That night, in the silence of Burnham's stateroom, as somewhere to the north the body of his last good friend drifted frozen in the strangely peaceful seas of the North Atlantic, Burnham opened his diary and began to write. He felt an acute loneliness. He wrote, "Frank Millet, whom I loved, was aboard her, thus cutting off my connection with one of the best fellows of the fair." Burnham lived only 47 more days. As he and his family traveled through Heidelberg, he slipped into a coma, the result apparently of a combined assault of diabetes, colitis, and his foot infection, all worsened by a bout of food poisoning. He died June 1st, 1912. Margaret eventually moved to Pasadena, California, where she lived through time of war and epidemic and crushing financial depression, and then war again. She died December 23, 1945. Both are buried in Graceland Cemetery, on a tiny island in the cemetery's only pond. John Root lies nearby, as do the Palmers, Lewis Sullivan, Mayor Harrison, Marshall Field, Philip Armour, and so many others, in vaults and tombs that vary from the simple to the grand. Potter and Bertha still dominate things, as if stature mattered even in death. They occupy a massive acropolis with 15 giant columns atop the only high ground overlooking the pond. The others cluster around. On a crystalline fall day, you can almost hear the tinkle of fine crystal, the rustle of silk and wool, almost smell the expensive cigars. Notes and sources. The thing that entranced me about Chicago in the Gilded Age was the city's willingness to take on the impossible in the name of civic honor, a concept so removed from the modern psyche that two wise readers of early drafts of this book wondered why Chicago was so avid to win the World's Fair in the first place. The juxtaposition of pride and unfathomed evil struck me as offering powerful insights into the nature of men and their ambitions. The more I read about the fair, the more entranced I became. That George Ferris would attempt to build something so big and novel, and that he would succeed on his first try, seems in this day of liability lawsuits almost beyond comprehension. A rich seam of information exists about the fair and about Daniel Burnham in the beautifully run archives of the Chicago Historical Society and the Ryerson and Burnham Libraries of the Art Institute of Chicago. I acquired a nice base of information from the University of Chicago's Suzzallo Library, one of the finest and most efficient libraries I have encountered. I also visited the Library of Congress in Washington, where I spent a good many happy hours immersed in the papers of Frederick Law Olmsted, though my happiness was at times strained by trying to decipher Olmsted's execrable handwriting. I read and mined dozens of books about Burnham, Chicago, the Exposition, and the late Victorian era. Several proved consistently valuable. Thomas Hines's Burnham of Chicago, 1974. Laura Wood Roper's FLO, A Biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, 1973, and Witold Rybczynski's A Clearing in the Distance, 1999. One book in particular, City of the Century by Donald L. Miller, 1996, became an invaluable companion in my journey through old Chicago. I found four guidebooks to be especially useful. Alice Sienkiewicz's AIA Guide to Chicago, Matt Huck and Ursula Bielski's Graveyards of Chicago, 1999, John Flynn's Official Guide to the World's Columbian Exposition, 1893, and Rand McNally and Company's Handbook to the World's Columbian Exposition, 1893. Huck and Bielski's guide led me to pay a visit to Graceland Cemetery, an utterly charming haven where, paradoxically, history comes alive. Holmes proved an elusive character, owing in large part to the Philadelphia judge's unfortunate decision to bar District Attorney Graham's 36 witnesses from giving testimony. Several books have been written about Holmes, but none tells quite the same story. Two of them, Harold Schechter's Depraved and David Frank's The Torture Doctor, the work quoted by the modern serial killer Dr. Swango, seem the most trustworthy. Two other works exist that provide a concrete foundation of facts. One is Detective Frank Geyer's memoir, The Holmes-Pititzel Case, a detailed account of events from the time of Holmes' arrest onward, in which Geyer presents excerpts of primary documents that no longer exist. I was lucky enough to acquire a copy from an online seller of antique books. The second is The Trial of Herman W. Mudgett, alias H.H. Holmes, published in 1897, a complete transcript of the trial. I found a copy in the Law Library of the University of Washington. Holmes left a memoir, Holmes's Own Story, which I found in the Library of Congress's rare book collection. He also made at least three confessions. The first two appear in Geyer's book. The third and most sensational appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer, which paid him a rich fee to write it. Though mostly untrue, his memoir and confessions were nuggeted with details that jibed with facts established in court or unearthed by Geyer and by the legions of reporters who covered Holmes' story after his arrest in Boston. I relied heavily on newspaper articles published in the Chicago Tribune and in two Philadelphia newspapers, the Inquirer and the Public Ledger. Many of these articles also were full of inaccuracies and, I suspect, embellishments. I mined them for bits of apparent fact and for reproductions of original documents, such as letters, telegrams, interviews, and other primary materials uncovered by police or produced by witnesses who stepped forward once the nature of Holmes's Castle of Horrors became front-page news. One of the most striking and rather charming aspects of criminal investigation in the 1890s is the extent to which the police gave reporters direct access to crime scenes, even while investigations were in progress. At one point during the Holmes investigation, Chicago's chief of police told a Tribune reporter he'd just as soon have a squad of reporters under his command as detectives. Exactly what motivated Holmes may never be known. In focusing on his quest for possession and dominance, I present only one possibility, though I recognize that any number of other motives might well be posited. I base my account on known details of his history and behavior, and on what forensic psychiatrists have come to understand about psychopathic serial killers and the forces that drive them. Dr. James O. Rainey, a Seattle psychiatrist who now and then provides forensic evaluations, read the manuscript and gave me his observations about the nature of psychopaths, known more tediously in today's psychiatric handbooks as people afflicted with antisocial personality disorder. It is a good thing Alfred Hitchcock died before the change was made. Clearly no one other than Holmes was present during his murders. No one, that is, who survived. Yet in my book I recreate two of his killings. I agonized over exactly how to do this and spent a good deal of time rereading Truman Capote's In Cold Blood for insights into how Capote achieved his dark and still deeply troubling account. Sadly, Capote left no footnotes. To build my murder scenes, I used threads of known detail and used these to weave a plausible account, as would a prosecutor in his closing arguments to a jury. My description of Julia Connor's death by chloroform is based on expert testimony presented at Holmes's trial about the character of chloroform and what was known at the time about its effect on the human body. I do not employ researchers, nor did I conduct any primary research using the Internet. I need physical contact with my sources, and there's only one way to get it. To me, every trip to a library or archive is like a small detective story. There are always little moments on such trips when the past flares to life, like a match in the darkness. On one visit to the Chicago Historical Society, I found the actual notes that Prendergast sent to Alfred Trude. I saw how deeply the pencil dug into the paper. I have tried to keep my citations as concise as possible. I cite all quoted or controversial material, but omit citations for facts that are widely known and accepted. For the two murder scenes, I document my reasoning and my approach, and cite the facts upon which I relied. The citations that follow constitute a map. Anyone retracing my steps ought to reach the same conclusions as I. This concludes the reading of Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. Copyright 2003 by Eric Larson. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in 2003 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by Scott Brick. Books on Tape produces many new audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, call our customer service department at the number which appears on this package, or visit us at our website, www.booksontape.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.